People have witnessed the academic betrayal in liberalism, where the so-called scholars are the ones who have attacked the Bible. And so people are afraid of that. They say, I don't want to get involved in study. I'm happy with Jesus. But the problem is that if our hearts are going to be on fire, the way God has made us is that the conduit to the heart is the mind. Mindless zeal has no virtue to it whatsoever.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn, where we're continuing our Romans Revolution. The first Reformation was about doctrine. The second one needs to be about behavior. Best-selling author Rick Warren told a Congress of the Baptist World Alliance last year, going on to quote him again, "We need a Reformation not of creeds, but of deeds." Throughout the speech, as reported on the group's website, Mr. Warren announced that a new movement is underway in the church, shifting the emphasis from doctrinal issues to service in the world. Quote, "It's time to stop debating the Bible and start doing it. This is the new Reformation I'm praying for," end quote. Now, this isn't a new message, however. In the history of evangelical revivalism, there has always been a running screed against everything formal, creedal, historical, and always been a play for the heart over against the head. At least in the evangelicalism I grew up in, the deeds over creeds speech is pretty familiar. Nearly any crazy fad in the church today can be justified by its success in conjuring emotional passion and zeal for good works, regardless of how quickly and how many victims of these revival fires get burned out in the process. Whatever its problems with Mary and the saints, Protestantism has shown time and again that it is just as capable of building towers of zeal reaching to the heavens in works righteousness. Nobody needs Paul's message here in Romans 10 that we'll be looking at in this program more than we do, and at no greater moment than ours. Zeal without knowledge is our subject in this program of the White Horse Inn, as we continue the Romans Revolution and do so with our usual hosts. The Reverend Dr. Kim Riddlebarger is pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod minister, is also professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine. And the Reverend Ken Jones is pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. I'm Mike Horton. I teach theology at Westminster Seminary, California. Gentlemen, a very important passage, and we begin with verse 1 chapter 10, continuing here our trek through Romans. "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they might be saved. I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge, for being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." Let's first of all, starting with that quote I began the commentary with from Pastor Rick Warren, the first Reformation was about doctrine. The second one needs to be about behavior. We need a Reformation not of creeds, but of deeds. Is there this perennial temptation in religion to have zeal without knowledge, to be impatient with doctrine?
There is a perennial temptation because many Christians unfortunately think the Christian faith is essentially about ethics. And if you're trying to grow the church, if your focus is on church growth and expansion in terms of the numbers of people that come to faith, if you want the large, you know, roster every year of all the new names, then you're going to make the highway with as many lanes on it as you possibly can. And the common denominator that all religions and that all religious people have is ethics. Mm-hmm. And so you move away from the distinctives of Christianity and its distinctive doctrines toward the kind of ethical practices that nominal religious people can affirm, Jews can affirm, even some Muslims can affirm, Roman Catholics can affirm, and yes, this broadly evangelical America can affirm. And the temptation is to move away from things that divide to things that unite and what unites is ethics.
So really, gay unions, gay mm-hmm. marriages will bring religious America together a lot more quickly and with a lot greater zeal than, say, the doctrine of the Trinity.
Well,
you
sure.
mean opposing gay marriages and
right.
gay unions.
But of course, you don't have the scandal of the gospel either. I mean, we used to associate this kind of nonsense with liberal Protestantism.
Yeah, that's the roots of this.
I mean, the gospel's gone.
Well, I challenge anyone who makes that claim. In the first place, you're going to have to prove to me that the problem of the evangelical church is too much doctrine.
Secondly, preach it, brother.
Sociologists have made it very clear that evangelicals are not well taught in their doctrine.
And secondly, you're going to also have to prove to me that the emphasis in the evangelical church since the Second Great Awakening hasn't been on ethics and practice. Isn't the moral majority and its failure, that the whole religious right thing, isn't that praxis?
Deeds over creeds?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And didn't that fail?
Yeah, Charles Finney, you refer to the Second Great Awakening. The leader of the Second Great Awakening in many ways was Charles Finney. And he wasn't an Arminian. Don't want to give Arminians a bad name. He was a Pelagian. I mean, he said that...
And not a semi-Pelagian, by the way.
No.
He was full-blown.
Oh, he didn't... Charles Finney denied original sin, justification, substitutionary atonement.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the church is basically a society of moral and social transformers. Finney gave rise to both liberal activism and conservative activism.
Yeah. Jesse Jackson and Jerry Falwell both had the same theological father, and it's Charles Finney.
Yeah. Prohibition was one of the things.
Exactly.
And abolitionism.
Something good came out of it.
Yeah, something good came out of it. Yeah. You had a personal stake in that, actually.
Yeah, literally.
But all kinds of different political positions that are identified either with the left-wing side of the aisle or the right-wing political side of the aisle were all comprehended in this one revivalistic movement that has now split into liberal Protestantism and conservative Protestantism, but it's all basically moralism.
Sure it is. And what doesn't occur to the conservative Protestant church in America is that the devil rejoices in this, the preaching of moralism.
Yeah.
I got to use the illustration that I used before. Donald Gray Barnhouse, the pastor many years ago of 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, said, what would it actually look like if Satan took over a city? And, of course, our minds run to all kinds of things that probably look a lot like our day.
Red light districts.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And he said, no, here's what it would look like if Satan took over a town. Be white picket fences. All of the yards would be very clean. There would be no gum on the sidewalks. The children would all say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir. Their hair would be trimmed. And all of the bars would be closed. There would be no foul language. And everyone would go to church twice every Sunday where Christ is not preached.
That is a great illustration.
It's wonderful.
That's the insidious character of Satan's work.
Well,
and it applies to going to church mm-hmm. where we're going to talk about a recipe for remaking you.
Mm-hmm. And the Bible will be open and used.
Yeah.
Christ just won't be preached from it, or at least not as the satisfaction of God's wrath, and certainly not as our Redeemer.
This is absolutely parallel to those first five verses in chapter 10. It is.
Absolutely.
I mean, I hear more and more people anymore who have visited evangelical churches. Christ wasn't even mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
I assumed it would be as the moral model to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh. His name doesn't even come up.
Yeah.
It isn't needed.
Yeah.
Or if it is, it's mentioned as role model, as Paul alludes to in 2 Corinthians 11, I think it is, when he speaks of another gospel, another Christ, and another spirit that you have not received. And he's not saying that someone will come in masquerading as Jesus, but simply that Jesus would be preached, but not as the lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world.
No.
Good role model, good leader, good business model.
Remember B.B. Warfield, the famous Princeton theologian, his critique of Charles Finney was interesting. He said, you know, Finney's got this wonderful system of ethics. The problem is he tries to make it theology. It'd be much better if he would take God out of it altogether.
Mm. Yeah.
Just treat it as a secular
natural theology.
Yeah, exactly. Treat it as natural law and you'll be fine. And that's unfortunately what we see going on with Rick Warren's kind of quote. Warren is basically saying we can unite around our practices instead of dividing around our beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so the more you focus on action, and let's say some of the things he's done is wonderful. I mean, the AIDS movement, there are lots of things he's involved in. They're all great causes. They're all wonderful causes. It's just they're not the gospel.
I think that it's something that is true not only of mainstream evangelicalism. This is true of a lot of our churches. We want to transform. It's not that our that the motives are necessarily bad.
Of course.
But it's that we're missing out here the whole emphasis that Paul is placing on the gospel when he says, I know it's counterintuitive because, as we'll see in the next program, law righteousness is intuitive.
Right.
That's what you know.
Right.
And this is not going to be intuitive. How can believing that you do nothing to contribute anything to your salvation possibly create a basis for ethics? Alexander Schweitzer said that there is no basis for any kind of ethics in the doctrine of justification as it was enunciated by the Reformers. Hmm. I mean, this is exactly what Paul himself had as objections. It comes up again and again. People will say, look, you guys think that you have it all wrapped up, it's all in your head, you have all the right doctrine, but you're not living it. And we can actually say, you know what? That is exactly why we need to be very clear about the doctrine so that we know who we can run to because we don't.
Sure.
Well, because you don't either.
Yeah, right. Nobody's living up to it. Nobody.
Sociologists will tell you if you're going to check empirically on members of churches across the board, it's all about equal if you're going to measure sanctification.
Right.
Not much difference. But didn't Paul give this in a verse in Romans 1 that he was going to talk about a righteousness not according to law?
Mm. Yeah.
Wasn't that in chapter 1?
Already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an announcement of what I'm going to do.
Yeah. On the line with us is Dr. R.C. Sproul, president of Ligonier Ministries and host of the radio program Renewing Your Mind. R.C., thanks for being with us on the White Horse Inn as we're going through the Romans Revolution.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to be a Palomino among all these white horses. I always get a big charge out of being with you guys on the inn.
R.C., we're currently in chapter 10, and we've arrived at Paul's warning about having zeal without knowledge. You think this is an important warning for us today in the American church?
Oh, no, Mike. I mean, I think today is an unprecedented time of biblical literacy. The church is overflowing with knowledge. Now, our problem today is that nobody seems to have any zeal. And if you believe that, I have some wonderful property down here in Florida that I'd like to sell you. No, I mean, I wonder if there's ever been a time where the church has been had more of a disjunction between knowledge and zeal than is manifest in our country today.
Not too long ago, Brian Chappell, the president of Covenant Seminary in St. Louis, gave us an interesting anecdote. He said that 20 years ago, a third of the incoming seminarians failed the initial Bible exam, showing they needed to take remedial courses. Today, he says, two-thirds, not one-third, but two-thirds, regularly fail that very same exam. What do you think is the cause of this decline in biblical literacy, even among those who are raised in the church, even conservative evangelical churches, and are heading to seminaries?
I'm not sure, Mike. You know, somebody just asked me that yesterday, and I'm sure there are a lot of converging factors that contribute to it, not the least of which is this pervasive sense of relativism in the culture, where people respond to life matters on the basis of personal preferences and feelings. All the accents on relationships, not on doctrine. If you're not interested in a doctrine, why would you read the Bible? Because that's what the Bible is. It's God's revealed truth, and it's content. But we've sort of departed from any concern for content. So that may be one of the reasons. A second reason is going back to the statistic that you just mentioned a moment ago about the men entering seminary in a state of biblical illiteracy, and the seminaries haven't done a whole lot to correct that problem. And when these fellows get out and go into churches, they're afraid to teach the Bible because they don't know it themselves. And so the congregation gets shortchanged. That's another thing. I mean, we've lost expository preaching. You know that as well as I do. But when the preachers are preaching pop psychology, entertainment, current events, what happens to Scripture?
Is Paul saying that we should pit zeal against knowledge, that we should pick the head over the heart?
No, absolutely not. It's that our zeal should be according to knowledge. I mean, God made us with minds. He also made us with hearts. And we know, you know, in the academic world, as I've known, that you can have everything correct in terms of your conceptual understanding of the faith. Your doctrine can be solid and so on, and your heart can be ice cold. And again, people have witnessed the academic betrayal in liberalism, where the so-called scholars are the ones who have attacked the Bible. And so people are afraid of that. They say, I don't want to get involved in study. I don't want to get involved in these things. I'm happy with Jesus. But the problem is that if our hearts are going to be on fire, the way God has made us is that the conduit to the heart is the mind. Mindless zeal has no virtue to it whatsoever.
R.C., how would you respond to people who say, I don't want head knowledge, I want heart knowledge?
You know the old saying, the more I know him, the more I love him. Mm-hmm. And the more I learn about God, the more I can know him personally. I can't know anybody personally that I don't know anything about.
What about Paul's criticism that knowledge puffs up?
Well, knowledge can puff up. And again, the ultimate goal of knowledge is not knowledge itself. Knowledge is never an end of itself. And knowledge apart from zeal, knowledge apart from love, would lead to arrogance and aloofness, and in fact can be a detriment if it's isolated from the heart. But we say in classical Reformed theology that there's a twofold primacy, and that may sound self-contradictory because you can only have one primacy, but you have a primacy with respect to order and a primacy with respect to importance. With respect to order, the primacy is the mind. As I said, you can't have it in the heart if you don't have it first in the mind. But the primacy of importance is the heart. The single most important thing is that our hearts are right with God. But that doesn't mean that we can get there apart from an understanding of who God is and what he teaches us in his word.
So you're not saying that knowledge saves us. We're not saved by what we know, but we can't be saved apart from knowing Christ.
Exactly right. Faith, I mean, an essential ingredient of faith is understanding. And you can't have understanding of something you know not of. I mean, we're not saved by faith in general. A lot of people think that. It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you're sincere. Well, you know, you could sincerely believe in Satan. That isn't going to justify anybody. You have to have an object to your faith, and that object has to be Christ. And it has to be the biblical Christ.
What is a particular bit of information that Paul complains in Romans 10 that the Jews of his day were ignorant of?
I don't think they understood the grounds by which we are saved. The issue of how can an unjust person escape the judgment of God on Judgment Day? When I have to stand before a just God and I am not just, the only thing that will save me is righteousness. And if I don't have it myself, which I don't, then I got to get it somewhere. And the biblical message is that that righteousness is supplied by the perfect righteousness of Jesus, which is imputed or transferred or deemed counted for all who put their trust in him.
Is this merely a Jewish problem?
I don't know of any issue in the church today that's more grave, more serious, had more lasting consequences than the debate over imputation, a word that most evangelicals don't even know what it means. But there you're talking about the very heart and soul of the gospel itself.
We recently did a survey at the National Pastors Convention asking various questions related to the themes in the book of Romans, And would you believe that when asked about the word imputation, 67% were initially unfamiliar with the term?
Well, that the term evangelical is a misnomer in this day and age. How in the world can you be an evangelical? I've never heard the term imputation. But again, Mike, you know, I've seen these kinds of surveys again and again and again. You and I have talked to some of the most visible Christian leaders in our country and in our time who were just incapable of even giving a basal definition of the gospel. You ask them about the cross, and they'll say, well, Jesus died for my sins, but that's about it. And, you know, the depth and the riches of the New Testament unveiling of all that is involved in that sacrificial work of Christ, in which he satisfies the wrath of God in behalf of his people, the depths and riches of the atonement is the tragedy is that Christians think they know the cross, but they don't. You remember the theme of the Reformation, post tenebras lux, after darkness light. But now the gospel has receded once more into the darkness. It's eclipsed, even in the so-called evangelical church. If you ask an ordinary self-proclaimed evangelical what the gospel is, they're saying, getting purpose for my life, having Jesus in my heart, having meaning to my existence, having a personal relationship with Jesus. Those are all nice things, but that's not the gospel. The gospel has a content of the person and work of Jesus, whose work is appropriated to us by faith and by faith alone.
We've been listening to R.C. Sproul. R.C., thank you very much for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
It's my pleasure, and give my love to everybody there, please.
You know, when we think of the objections that we hear most, it comes down to Romans 10, verse 1. It's the thing we hear over and over again. You guys are about getting all of your doctrinal ducks in a row, as if we're simply on a head trip here. We just want to bury people in facts or whatever.
Yeah, right. Nobody's living up to it.
Nobody is.
Sociologists will tell you if you're gonna check empirically on members of churches across the board, it's all about equal if you're gonna measure sanctification.
Right.
Not much difference. But didn't Paul give this in a verse in Romans 1 that he was gonna talk about a righteousness not according to law?
Mm. Yeah.
Wasn't that in chapter 1?
Already. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an announcement of what I'm gonna do.
Yeah. And we, you know, when we think of the objections that we hear most, it comes down to Romans 10, verse 1. It's the thing we hear over and over again. You guys are about getting all of your doctrinal ducks in a row, as if we're simply on a head trip here. We just want to bury people in facts or whatever. Whereas what we are interested in is the heart and the hands. We want to see our young people with tears coming down their eyes, waving their hands at a Christian concert. We want to see
pure lives.
Pure lives. We want to see on Nightline young people committing their lives to chastity.
Right.
And now this is important work, and trying to stop AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the church is all about. And what Paul is saying is, no, those are all good things.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely good things, but they're all law things. The thing that saves you, the story I've been trying to tell you about since chapter 1, this story is not about you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about what you will. It's not about what you decide. It's not about what you feel. It's not about what you do. It's about God and what he feels and what he's decided and what he's done.
Well, here's a clear call for category distinctions. Because Paul will address the issue of works and our place and our responsibilities in the culture and in the church at a later point.
Yep.
But here the issue is, what gives you a right standing before God? And if you assume that your zeal as it relates to good works is what gives you a right standing before God, as we mentioned last week in the last chapter about your choosing God, if you think any of these things is what gives you a right standing before God, then you have sorely missed the point.
And let's remember, too, that the Pharisees here were not slackards.
Mm-mm.
No.
Paul's talking about a people. Look, their zeal is incredible. They were concerned with the ceremonial washings. They were concerned with dietary laws. the observance of feast days. They really thought that the Messianic kingdom had been manifest because they were going to ensure through their oral tradition that everything done in Israel was going to be done according to the law.
Philippians 3 says, look at me.
Yeah.
I was so zealous, I persecuted the church.
So their zeal is incredible. And the zeal of the Pharisees has to exceed the zeal of most American evangelicals. I mean, we're talking about people that devoted every minute of every day to a ritual observance of oral tradition and thereby thinking that they were obeying the law.
If you find a coin on the street, you tithe, you include that in your tithes, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. So those are the people Paul's talking about. And he says their zeal does not account them as righteous.
Yeah.
So let's take the top 1%, the Mother Teresa's, you know, those who have manifested an incredible piety and who manifest it publicly and the person that everyone emulates and desires to be like. Paul says that does not justify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It may help your neighbor.
Yep.
Sure.
It may be a really wonderful thing for you to do. It may be a vocation to which God is calling you.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't the gospel.
And Mike, I want to return to this because I think this is such an unfair characterization on the part of non-Reformed Christians as it relates to those who are Reformed. The assumption that those who are concerned about doctrine are not concerned about righteousness, personal good deeds, to whatever extent, whether it's just in the church, in the family, in the community. That is so unfair. I think on both sides we do have a tendency to wrongly present the other side and maybe give extremes as if you know, from our vantage point, that those who are not Reformed are not concerned about doctrine. They are. It's just wrong doctrine. But I think
wrong practice
and wrong practice, exactly. But I it's so unfair when you hear people assume because you are concerned about doctrinal precision that you're not concerned about godliness in the community and in the church and in charitable deeds.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think if you're properly concerned about doctrine, you're going to see a different solution to the human problem.
Yes.
And so because we see a different solution to the human problem, which is a righteousness that comes from God and is received by faith, we're going to look for different ways of implementing change in the society. So when someone like Rick Warren looks at a Reformed church and says, well, they're small, they're not growing, they're not reaching out, it's because he's looking for kinds of things that fit with his egalitarian, prosperous, white Orange County kind of paradigm. Whereas we're talking about somebody seeing themselves as a sinner, seeing themselves in need of a justifying righteousness, believing the proper things, and then being tied to a local congregation where the word is preached, where they're catechized, where the sacraments are administered. And again, remember, Scripture ties outreach first to the local congregation, and only then, once the needs of the local congregation are met, only then to those outside the church. And so because...
And then, even then, it's more a matter of those who are members of the church functioning within the context of the culture, not doing it necessarily in the name of the church.
Exactly. Right. Great point.
Yeah, there's this assumption that the church equals the sum total of Christians. No, the church is an institution ordained for the purpose of delivering the gospel through word and sacrament. Christians are called to scads of vocations that the church is not called to.
Yep.
So Christians can do all kinds of things. Ministers can do all kinds of things that are not part of the ministry of the church, per se. Now, we're not saying that knowledge without zeal is okay, are we?
No.
No.
Not at all.
No, it's a straw man.
But yeah, and that's what makes that argument so unfair, and we've heard it over and over again. This is what we need, and like I said, it's assuming in the first place that evangelicals are overly concerned about doctrine, and it just makes some dangerous assumptions.
Or that we're zealous. Again, looking at the statistics... Now, I mean, this is the same thing, too. Rome's critique has always been, well, if you believe this, you'll just go and send your daylights out.
That's Romans 6:1.
Yeah, it's
right,
Romans 6:1.
Exactly.
And
which is answered.
The irony of it all is the Rome that has said that has been a cesspool of idolatry and immorality for centuries.
And with a whole bunch of money to keep it going.
Yeah.
And quiet.
Now, so have our churches.
Yeah.
This is not a moral superiority thing. The question is, when a church really messes up, and it's not a question of when, but how often in a day, when a church or a person really messes up, how big is the grace there to cover that? And Paul's answer is, where sin abounds, grace does much more abound. That's why the irony of it all, the irony of it all is, if you start with God and His grace, you'll get a zeal that is called gratitude. If you start with you and your zeal, you'll not only not get the gospel and therefore confound the doctrine, get the doctrine all messed up, you will only have a zeal based on selfishness, a zeal based on how can I get either eternal life or jewels in my crown.
Adulation of the crowds.
That's right.
Yep. And Paul says in this whole discussion, if you take Romans 10 as kind of the first four verses of Romans 10, it's kind of the hinge of this whole section in Romans 9 to 11, where Paul's saying what's lacking isn't zeal. What's lacking is a knowledge of the righteousness that comes from God.
Right.
Which is a knowledge of the person and work of Christ.
And the righteousness imputed.
Yes. Exactly. So the problem isn't getting people all excited and motivating huge numbers of people to go transform a culture. The problem is that people, because they're sinful, when they engage in those kinds of transformational activities apart from the gospel, think that the transforming of society is the end in itself. Right. Paul's saying, no, the end in itself is knowing the righteousness that comes from God.
I mean, these people want Romans to begin with chapter 12, verse 1.
Right.
And not even there, because Paul says in Romans chapter
12,
by the renewing of your mind.
Yeah. Right.
And see, what Paul there is setting out is that doctrine shapes the zeal. And we all have doctrine. The question is whether it's God-centered or man-centered. And if you start with man and his needs and his felt needs and his desires and so forth, you're going to get a different kind of gospel. If basically you say man's happiness is what it's all about, man's wholeness is what it's all about, man's well-being is what it's all about, you're going to say the gospel is all about figuring out how to fix the world's problems. If you start with God and you say, wait, here, let me tell you about his felt needs. Let me tell you about his holiness, his glory, his majesty, his righteousness, his justice. Now, where are you going to go to flee that? And it's Christ.
Let me give you a couple of concrete examples. J.I. Packer writes a book called Knowing God. Rick Warren writes 40 Days of Purpose. Just a clear illustration of the distinction of that point you just made.
I've used this illustration before, but if you tell me you have this relationship, you've fallen in love with this girl, and you just think she's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and you go on and on and on about the relationship, and I ask you, well, tell me about her, and you say, well, I don't want to know about her. That would ruin the relationship. I just want to know her. I would say, you're nuts, and you don't deserve her, whoever she is.
You're describing a year of my seminary training with liberal Lutherans.
But see, we don't do that in our normal everyday relationships, but we often hear people say, it's a relationship, not a doctrine. Well, all doctrine is telling you who it is with whom you have a relationship and what the nature of that relationship actually is. We've got to stop putting putting doctrine in the box of theory over here, and then zeal in the box of practice over here.
It's a false dichotomy.
It really is.
Yeah, and it's an unfair one. I mean, it's not either or.
It's foreign to the Bible text.
Yeah.
Yes.
It really is.
Yeah.
What we're doing here about the depth of sin and the greatness of Christ and his cross and his rescue is a Bible view of where zeal comes from. It is.
Yeah,
Rod, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's hard to say this and not sound like a Pharisee, but the kind of cultural and societal activism that comes out of evangelicalism is not Bible-based. It's pragmatic. It's utilitarian.
It comes from
all the Enlightenment categories Ken, you were mentioning earlier. It doesn't come from Paul. Paul talks about zeal and how zeal is a great thing, but unless it's tied to the righteousness of God in Christ, that zeal is damning.
But here's the danger there, Kim, and I guess the difficulty. I agree with you that it's not biblical but it's coming from people who are reading the Bible.
Wrongly. Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, these are the same people that are turning to the First Chronicles passage. If my people who are called by my name, and that is the rallying cry for some of their activism. So it comes from people who have somehow managed to read the Bible from a non-Christocentric perspective.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for the ICBI in the past, the ones who fought for inerrancy and won. They, you know, Packer and R.C. and all, and Robert
Dr.
Preuss.
Boyce and all.
Mm-hmm. No, but there's a way in which, in my tradition, that wasn't enough. I'm really grateful for it. But in our confessions, we will say the whole Bible is about Christ.
Yep.
I used to say to my Westmont students, I'm going to tell you something really radical. The Bible's about Christ. And they'd yawn and say, oh, we know that. And I'd say, all right, tell me what you're preaching in your local church is. And it was all like we've been describing. It was all recipes and holiness and progress and all. I said, so tell me, where's the gospel in that? And the answer is there isn't any.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And see, that's what I think that is a greater problem. If we do need a second Reformation, the first Reformation came at a time when people did the average layperson didn't have access to the scriptures, but now the second Reformation, if it's needed, and I think it is, it comes among a people who have open Bibles and many versions of it.
Well, remember the first Reformation came at a time where people were laden down with guilt and didn't hear a gospel.
Yep.
Now we're talking to people who have no guilt and no shame.
Yeah.
Yeah, their need focuses on a second BMW 700 series,
right,
at least here in Orange County.
Yeah.
That is a legitimate need.
In the context of Romans 10, what were the Jews zealous about? You've touched on this a little bit, Kim, but what were they ignorant of?
They were zealous about, especially the Pharisaical tradition at the time of Paul, Second Temple Judaism. The Pharisees, well, a little bit of history here. The Sanhedrins were the liberal. The Sadducees were the liberals. They denied the validity of angels, didn't believe in a resurrection. The Pharisees were the theological conservatives. They believed in a bodily resurrection. They really and truly believed that for the Messianic age to dawn, Israel must be holy before the Lord, citing the passage from Leviticus. They were committed to seeing the nation of Israel empirically holy, and that meant regulating all of life by the Torah as interpreted through Pharisaical oral tradition. So there were rules and regulations for everything. That's what Paul's up against. People who were extremely zealous and who thought that if Israel as a nation would be holy before God, then the Messiah would appear in whatever way, shape, or form, and that Israel would receive the blessing of God, victory from Rome, the glory would return to the temple.
So everybody get zealous.
Everybody get zealous. And we're talking about not just evangelical zeal, as we know, where you go to revival every night of the week, but a zeal,
rigor
that extends to every area of your life. And so Israel had, after all of this, had attained this external righteousness, and yet Jesus and Paul now say that kind of righteousness is nothing but dung.
In fact, the Pharisees, there were two parties of the Pharisees, the Shammai and the Hillel, and Paul was a Hillel Pharisee, which is why he was even persecuting the church. The Shammai Pharisees wouldn't have persecuted the church, at least in executing them. But the Hillel were the zealous of the zealots for the law. And that's why Paul says, speaks of the rigor of the fathers, the way a Hillel Pharisee would have spoken about the tradition. Paul here is not at all a guy who is sort of a freewheeling, well, God loves you anyway.
No.
He understands the law in a way that none of us really ever will.
It was the zeal for the law that caused the Pharisees to take up stones to stone Christ.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a parallel. One of the best lectures on Luther is given by R.C.
R.C. Sproul?
Yeah, The Insanity of Luther. It is a great, and it's the same issue.
The more zealous you are, the more burned out you become, and you either go to total desperation or you pretend you're pulling it off and make everybody else your subject.
Rick Warren going to Africa and delivering thousands of people from AIDS is a great thing.
Absolutely.
But it does nothing to save a single soul.
You know, again, non-Christians can have that kind of zeal. That's the kind of
sure.
zeal.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That, the UN can accomplish a lot of that.
Sure. Right. And Christians should support all kinds of different efforts that are not necessarily the church doing its job.
Right.
But if we take our focus off of what the church is supposed to be doing.
And you know what? That's a key that people are under the assumption that these are the types of things the church is supposed to be about.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
That if you are not anti-abortion and if you don't have an anti-abortion group in your church and if you don't have some kind of pipeline with an organization to relieve AIDS in Africa, if you don't do these things,
you're not a real church.
You're not. Yeah, you're,
it's a mark of the church.
If you're not reaching the community
yep.
with these programs and these things, that you're not doing your job as a church.
How many letters do we get from people asking, can you tell me if there's a church that preaches the gospel in this town?
Constantly.
Yeah.
Is there anybody that will preach the gospel to
right.
me in this town?
Ken, I'm going to put you on the spot, but what are you doing next week?
Next Saturday, I will leave for Africa.
And what are you going to do there?
I will be conducting 2 or 3 pastors' conferences, one in Kenya and one in Malawi. And this will be by an organization. It'll be sponsored by an organization that has established not only orphanages, but patterns for various African villages to deal with the orphan problem in various African countries.
This is Rosemary Jensen
Rafiki. Rafiki Foundation.
The Rafiki Foundation. You know, there are countless examples that you can point to like this. We don't do it because it's not a matter of lining people up. You know, how many pious zealots do you have on your side versus
right.
our side? But it is to say, look, here are people who actually are driven. They would tell you they're driven to overcome obstacles in front of them to help their neighbor because of a zeal that was created
yes,
by the gospel,
by the gospel
of grace.
And you know what? One of the unique things about something like Rafiki is the reason David Wells and I go over to do the pastors' conferences is because Rosemary recognizes that what she's doing in terms of the orphans or the orphanages is not the same thing as sharing the gospel. So mm-hmm. we go to minister to the preachers that will be preaching in these villages, and she is providing medical care. She's providing education and job training. But she makes a clear distinction between church and
mm-hmm.
community,
mm-hmm.
even though she's involved in both.
You know, it's not just Paul. Jesus, you know, the parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee, again and again, in fact, in his clashes with the Pharisees. This is a big part. This is not just Paul. This is Jesus. Throughout his entire 3-year ministry, perhaps the number one running conflict
yeah.
is the conflict with the Pharisees.
Yeah. Interestingly, I try to remind guys of this, and I think it's accurate. The word ecclesia occurs 2 times in all 4 Gospels total. I think the reference to justification occurs once. And it's in the parable of the tax collector.
Luke 18.
But there, you've got an answer to the one that you're talking about that runs all the way through the whole Bible. That is, how can a sinner be justified before a holy God?
And let's go, what kind of a sinner? Tax collectors were
scum of the earth.
They were Jewish.
They were Jewish. They were
squeezed their fellow Jews.
Exactly.
They got kicked out of their homes, excommunicated from their synagogues, disowned by their parents. Basically considered lackeys for the Roman Empire, and everybody hated Rome, or for Herod, for that matter.
Jesus said, zeal for your house consumes me. So zeal does save us, but it's Christ's zeal, right?
Yeah.
It's because he was
exactly.
consumed
yeah.
with zeal.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Father didn't say to the Son, quit wearing out the tile in my temple.
Right.
He said it to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, when Jesus said that was after he had beat some people up in the temple.
Yeah. Well, and Augustus Toplady in his hymn Rock of Ages, you know, though my zeal no respite know, though my tears forever flow, not for sin could these atone, thou must save and thou alone. I remember growing up, going forward for the 13th time, really, if anyone asked me, I'd say, no, this isn't the truth. But it was.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I could atone
yeah.
by the degree of my remorse,
mm-hmm.
evidenced through my tears,
yep. yeah.
through the sincerity of my prayer. And so it is such a relief to be freed from concern about this consuming concern about how am I doing today, and to be freed for our neighbor. Calvin had a great letter to Cardinal Sadoleto. Cardinal Sadoleto tried to get Geneva to come back to the fold, and Geneva said, Master Calvin, would you please send a letter to the Duke of Savoy and to Cardinal Sadoleto? And so Calvin sends this letter, and the letter basically says, your father was a hamster and your mother smells of elderberries.
So, two doctrines, church and justification.
Yes. So he writes back, and he says to Cardinal Sadoleto, look, you've obviously never really had a spiritual crisis in your life, because if you had ever, I know it's pretty bold to say that to a cardinal, you've never had a real profound experience of the wrath of God. If you had, he said, this wouldn't all be dismissed as unimportant intellectual logic chopping and doctrinal niceties. It's not doctrinal niceties. Secondly, your doctrine, your theology, keeps a person constantly focused on himself and saving his own skin for his entire life to such an extent that he can never one moment look outside of him either to Christ or his neighbor.
And your priest's preaching does that.
That's right. He says, now, if on the other hand you preach Christ and people turn out of themselves to Christ, then they also are able to turn out of themselves to their neighbor.
That's Paul's point here. If they knew this righteousness that came from God, then their zeal would be in accordance with knowledge.
So now he says, ironically, by knowing that we're saved already by God's justifying mercy alone in Jesus Christ, that's done, that's finished, we are free for the first time in our life to love someone, even who's not a Christian, even who's not lovely in himself or herself, even who despises the name of Christ and the gospel. We are able to love that person
in a way that we couldn't have the other way around.
That's right, without any eye toward fear of punishment or hope of rewards.
Well, that's why I like what you said, Kim, that Paul is not saying zeal instead of knowledge.
Right.
His denouncement of the Jews is that they have zeal but not according to knowledge.
Misguided.
And knowledge here, we got to reinforce this. Knowledge here is of the substitutionary atonement of Christ and the imputed righteousness rather than by law or works of law.
Exactly. Yeah. Which he makes clear, I think, in verse 4.
Verse 4, Christ is the end of the law. Christ is the telos, the fulfillment of the law for those who believe.
And we're going to be getting to that in the next program, focusing. But it's important to say that toward the end of this program so that people realize... Otherwise,
knowledge is not in abstracto.
Exactly. Right. If people just heard this and didn't tune in next week, they might walk away saying, this is just, an abstract defense of intellectualism versus emotionalism. That's not what Paul's doing here. Paul is saying there's a particular thing they're ignorant of that corresponds to their zealous works righteousness. Mm-hmm. They would stop putting their confidence in their own zeal if they only really understood this thing, which is the righteousness from God
in Christ,
in Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Not the righteousness of God apart from Christ. And that is exactly what our zealous striving is all about, trying to reconcile ourselves to that God of wrath, actually.
Attempting to meet the righteous requirement established by God through our zeal and our works. And boy, our righteousness means absolutely nothing without the righteousness of Christ. And of course, again, the zeal, he's not denouncing zeal. He's simply saying that there is a zeal that is in response to the gospel.
You know, in Ephesians 4, Paul also said along similar lines, he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may no longer be children, tossed back and forth by the waves. That's the church today, certainly. And carried around by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning marketing, by craftiness and deceitful scheming. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ. Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do, in the stupidity of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, due to the hardness of heart. You see, boy, I'll tell you, there are no easy airtight compartments between theory and practice there.
No, in fact, from verse 11 through 16, he covers all bases. And one part of verse 16 that you passed over was the dynamic of our interchurch relationships, where he says each joint supplies strength to the other as each one does its part. And that follows the idea of speaking the truth in love. That is that zeal. That zeal first has its community, has its root in church community, and it spreads out as a result of that. But it's built, and notice the dynamics earlier in the passage. Why do we have pastors and teachers? So that we would be brought to the unity of the faith, so that we would be nurtured and prepared for the work of ministry. And what is the work of ministry? Edmund Clowney says that it's number one, it's serving God in worship. Number two, it's serving the world in witness. And number three, it's serving the church itself in nurture and love.
But you cannot serve unless you've been served.
Absolutely.
And you can't witness unless you testify to the righteousness of God.
Exactly.
You have nothing to say.
Nothing to say.
Because you're not. It's not a witness to yourself and your piety. It's a witness to Christ and His. Folks, it is good news that we are saved by Christ's zeal and not our own. There is nothing in us at all that can reconcile us to a holy God. The only thing that God finds worthy of His acceptance is His Son, Jesus Christ. And all who are in Jesus Christ, by grace alone, through faith alone, find a smiling face, because God has not overlooked our sin, but has imputed the righteousness of His Son to us. Zeal for His house consumed Him, because He knows that zeal for God's house does not tragically consume us. And because it consumed Him, we won't be consumed by God's judgment on the last day. Look forward to being with you again next week on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.